as the bear swept a claw across three men, slashing their throats open. "Taryn," she said, but he ignored her, continuing to pace. As the battle had progressed, he'd grown more and more agitated, until she could barely get more than a growl of response from him. "Taryn!" Still nothing, his fingers flexing and opening around the handle of his Morning Star. "Sit down," she said. "That is a command." He stopped pacing, his chest rising and falling, but he still refused to look at her. He didn't sit, just watched, as the bear killed two more men. "Taryn," she said again. "Sit down. I command it." He didn't sit. Though he'd become more distant over the course of the day, this was the first time he'd disobeyed a direct command. Anise grunted as she fought to her feet. He faced away from her, those giant hands curling and uncurling, forever in motion. He was muttering something under his breath, but she couldn't discern the words. She slipped her hands around him across his chest. She had expected him to stiffen, perhaps to try to pull away from her. Instead, his elbow shot back, catching her in the temple, the hard armor like a battering ram knocking her back. Stars pulsed around her vision as it dimmed, her legs crumpling. She closed her eyes, willing the world to stop spinning, trying not to think about the fact that the love of her life had hit her. The world blinked back into focus, and Taryn stood over her, his faceplate lifted, his mesh covering pulled down. His mouth was wrenched into something between a snarl and a twisted curve of horror. "What have you done?" he asked. Anise had no time to wonder whether he was asking her or the thing inside of him, the monster that had taken the beautiful boy he'd been, the compassionate, gentle man he'd become, and carved it into someone out of control, a creature of violence and bloodlust. She had no time, because at that very moment, the giant bear reared up, turning in their direction. Its forepaws thumped down, and it charged. "Look out, Taryn!" Anise cried. But it was too late. The bear's monstrous strides devoured the space between them, and it swiped Taryn aside, knocking him into the air. His armor clanked heavily as he bounced off the stone wall before thudding to the ground. "Taryn!" Anise yelled, but he wasn't moving. The bear stood over her, one paw on either side, its maw opening to reveal fangs dripping with black saliva. "This is it," she knew. A prayer flitted through her, for Archer. It was his kingdom now, and he needed to recover to see it through, to take down their uncle. The bear's mouth drew closer, stopping so close she could feel its hot breath on her face, see its eyes boring into her. Those eyes. Somehow, impossibly, inexplicably, those eyes were familiar to Anise, brown orbs as deep as the ocean. And she knew. She knew. "Sir Jonius," she said. The bear seemed to startle at hearing the name, rising up slightly, clamping its mouth shut, blinking in confusion. In Anise's peripheral vision, she saw Taryn stir. "Not dead," she thought, relief swirling through her stomach. She refocused on the massive bear. "Sir Jonius," she said again. "Do you remember me? It's Anise, your little snow angel. I have returned." Sir Jonius, the man who had always been kind to her as a child, who'd brought her presents on her name day, who never failed to wink at her as he passed. The man who'd carried out atrocities for her father. The man who had imprisoned her brother, watched as her mother was executed. The man who had let them escape from Castle Hill. The most confusing man Anise had ever met was now a monster. "You're still in there," she said. "I have to believe that." The bear unleashed another roar, so loud she was forced to cover her ears with her hands. On the edge of her vision, Taryn rose, stalking toward the bear, swinging Morning Star over his head. "Taryn," Anise said, "stop! I command it!" He stopped for a moment, continuing to swing his weapon. His face was a miasma of confusion, a river of blood streaming from a slash in his forehead. Anger, frustration, fear, sadness. She could see them all coalescing in his haggard expression. He started forward once more.
No,
Anise said.
Don't! I know this man.
Terin stopped. This time he remained still, letting Morningstar fall to the ground. She gazed back at the bear.
Sir Jonius, this is not you. You are no monster. You are a knight of the realm, and thus you are sworn to obey the ruler of the kingdom. That is me. I am Queen Anise Gerrick, come to reclaim my throne from the impostor king.
The bear, Sir Jonius, reared up on its hind legs, raising its clawed paws, preparing to stomp down.
I tried,
Anise thought. To her surprise, the bear turned away, motioning with its snout toward the archway leading to the rest of the castle. Anise rose. Her soldiers were approaching, their weapons drawn. Sir Dietrich, Sir Metz. She waved them down.
Men! This is Sir Jonius. He is one of us now. Do not harm him. Understood?
The soldiers eyed the bear warily, but nodded. He roared once more and charged deeper into the castle. After only a moment's hesitation, the men followed.
48, Sir Metz said.
91. That was the latest count. Anise knew they'd all be dead already if not for Sir Jonius in all his monster bear glory. Fighting beside she and her men, he'd helped them slay dozens of beasts. Another stone monster. A creature made of snow that reformed its limbs when they shattered. A bull the size of a catapult. On and on, monster after monster battled them. Sir Jonius was leaking blood from numerous wounds, his dark fur matted and slick, red blood dripping behind him in the snow. But still he fought on, occasionally looking back to meet Anise's eyes. Anise was still woozy from when Terin had hit her, but the adrenaline had served her well, and she fought on, afraid to stop to rest for even a single moment. Afraid that if she did, she would lie down and not get back up. In between monsters, Anise tried to get Terin's attention, but he was lost inside himself again, his helmet still off, his translucent cheeks crusted with rivulets of dried blood and bulging with black veins. When a new monster appeared, Terin fought alongside Jonius, roaring and whipping Morningstar with all the force of a winter storm. On one occasion he killed a monster, a 12-eyed, shell-armored monstrosity, by shattering its carapace and digging out its heart.
"You're incredible," he'd said to her earlier.
It felt like a lifetime ago. Though, in a way, he was incredible too, but watching the fury with which he fought sent a dark wave of dread down her spine.
93,
Sir Metz shouted. Two more monsters had fallen, human bodies littered around them. Five more foes emerged all at once. It seemed her uncle, in his final stand, had abandoned his strategy of releasing one at a time. The first three were of the usual variety, a creature made of bone with long, sharp shards for hands, a beast that seemed to be made of tar, which oozed behind it like a black stream, a giant caterpillar with thousands of legs, and a maw filled with a dozen rows of pincer-like teeth. But the last two were different. For one, they were even larger, stretching toward the sky. For another thing, they both took on the shape of men. One was formed from ice, and wore a crown of icicles. A long beard formed of snow blanketed his chin and chest. Anise recognized him immediately. The Ice Lord. The bearer of the Ice Mark, a cruel man who'd murdered hundreds during his appointment as her father's weapon. Now he was as tall as the walls of Castle Hill. The second man was her uncle, Lord Griswold, the impostor king himself, except now he was made of metal and wielding an axe the size of a tree. He drank the rest of the potion, Anise knew. Half for him, half for the Ice Lord. Their final stand. The two leaders waited at the back, watching as their last three monsters attacked. The caterpillar stampeded through the remaining men, swallowing several whole before being hacked to pieces by Sir Dietrich and Terin. Anise fought alongside Sir Metz, who was as talented with the sword as anyone, save perhaps Sir Dietrich.
and Zelda, who was as fierce now as when they took down the very first monster. Together, along with the remaining archers and several spearmen, they managed to dispatch the tar creature, though at least a dozen men vanished into its black slime in the process. Sejonius fought the last creature on his own, ripping off chunks of bone with his enormous paws. Even when a sliver of bone punctured his chest, he was able to bite through its spindly spine. The monster fell to pieces, revealing another dead man.
97, Samet said.
The Imposter King stepped forward and laughed, a hollow rumble that seemed to penetrate Anise's chest, rattling her heart. He swung his axe. Anise dove to the side as it crashed into the ground, opening up a long slash in the earth. It took her uncle a moment to wrench the axe head from the ground, and Anise took advantage of the respite to race forward, slashing even Star across his ankles. The spiked ball rebounded without effect, glancing off thick metal boots. He kicked at her, and his toe caught her midsection, picking her up and tossing her through the air. The world spun, and then she landed softly. Sejonius's soft brown eyes stared down at her as the giant bear set her back on her feet. And then he charged into battle, swiping his claws across her uncle's abdomen. Though his claws were sharp, they did little but score thin marks in the metal. Lord Griswold slapped the bear away lazily with the back of his iron hand. Her uncle stepped back to regroup, watching as the Ice Lord swept his hand across the last group of archers, who were firing fletched arrows into his icy skin. The second his fingers touched them, they froze into statues. When he swung his arm back the other way, they crumbled to ice dust under the blow. Anise whirled around. There were so few of them left. Sir Dietrich was rallying a few soldiers to him, preparing for a final attack. Terin fought on his own, bludgeoning her uncle with Morningstar while he looked down like a god, laughing. Sir Metz had formed his own small pack, who now surrounded the Ice Lord, trying to hack his thick ice legs to pieces. She was surprised to see Sir Craig still alive, fighting bravely, a far cry from the staggering knight she'd known to fall first in tournaments. Anise wobbled on her feet, trying to decide what to do. No option seemed right. Every path seemed to end in death, both hers and the few of her soldiers that remained. Somewhere in her battered brain she had a thought, an idea.
"To me,"
she said, but it came out as naught but a whisper. Another soldier was frozen by the Ice Lord. A spearman was crushed under her uncle's metal boot. She took a deep breath.
"To me,"
she shouted, her voice rising over the clank of metal on metal. All heads turned her way, and then, without hesitation, they ran toward her. All except for Terin, who continued fighting her uncle, a tiny whirlwind in the midst of a tornado. Even Sejonius lumbered over to listen, though the other soldiers kept their distance from the bear, whose chest was ornamented with a bone shard. Anise couldn't think about Terin now, not when her last 2 dozen men and her aunt were staring at her, waiting. Every second was a risk. Every moment carried a weight, the potential to be their last.
"Let the Ice Lord kill the Imposter King," she said. "It's the only way."
At first all she got were confused looks, but then Sir Dietrich nodded in understanding.
"Yes. Men, harry the Ice Lord from the side facing the Imposter King. When the Ice Lord reacts, flee toward Lord Griswold."
The men nodded, their weary faces armoured with determination. As one, they charged back into the fray. Terin was dodging axe blows from her uncle, and though he was but an ant next to the giant he faced, Anise swore he stood at least a head taller than before, his armour looking awkwardly small. She shook off the thought, and raced after her men, who were closing in on the Ice Lord. He reached out to touch them.
"Ah!"
Dietrich yelled, dodging the touch, slicing off one of the Ice Lord's fingers, which shattered when it hit the ground. The others shouted too, and then Anise found herself releasing a war cry, swinging Evenstar wildly, hitting any piece of ice she could reach. One of her soldiers, who was no longer a man but ice, crumpled to the ground. She accidentally brushed up against Sejonius's thick coat, but he barely noticed, so intent was he on raking his claws across the Ice Lord's legs.
"Retreat!"
Dietrich shouted.
The group turned sharply, like they were each a part of one creature, Sejonius included, and sprinted toward the impostor king. Anise glanced back. As she had hoped, the Ice Lord, enraged at having had chunks of his legs slashed off, dove after them, long icy fingers outstretched, reaching for them, reaching for her. Anise threw herself to the side at the same time many of the others did. As she tumbled, she saw that one man had been a beat behind, turning to ice midway through his dive, shattering as his frozen body hit the ground. Sir Craig. A pang of sadness hit Anise, but she shook it away as she rolled to a stop. Now was not the time for mourning. Not yet. She watched as the Ice Lord's momentum carried him toward his master, Lord Griswold himself. The metal giant tried to dodge out of the way, but his size became his disadvantage. He was too slow by half, the Ice Lord's fingers brushing across his calf. Anise held her breath. Nothing happened. The metal gleaming in the sun.
No,
Anise thought. She was out of answers, out of ideas. How did one defeat a man made of metal, and a giant no less? Her breath rushed out of her as she saw it. A streak of white appeared on his calf, spreading across the metal, rushing up his legs, along his torso, and into his chest. Her uncle stared down, his metal mouth gaping open in surprise. His arms froze, and then his mouth too, still open. The rest of his head was consumed last. Terin swung Morningstar across Lord Griswold's frozen boots, shearing through the ice like it was nothing but wet paper. His giant leg crumpled, and the weight of the rest of him jerked to the side, snapping his other leg in half. When his body hit the ground, it shattered into a million pieces, a mountain of crushed ice. The Ice Lord seemed so shocked by the turn of events that he didn't even bother to defend himself, as Terin smashed Morningstar through him next, bringing him to his knees before landing a final blow to his skull. He too cracked, and joined the icy rubble that had once been his master. While the few survivors watched, Terin brought his weapon down again and again and again. No one tried to stop him. Anise turned and walked away, unable to watch the spectacle any longer, going to comfort her aunt, who was sitting on the ground, cradling a chunk of ice resembling Sir Craig's head. Part 4. Rhea. Grey. Raven. Roan. Jai. The Beggar. Anise. Though the fate-marked shall at times be pulled toward their individual destinies with such force they will feel powerless to stop their momentum, in the end they will each have the same choice we all have, to act for good or evil. The Western Oracle. 34. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Ennis had painted her into a corner, and though at times Rhea was a wildcat, there was no clawing and biting her way out of this one. He had chosen death, and she would give it to him and her people. She was no coward, not any more. No, that girl was trapped in Rhea's past, a jumble of old, crinkled, fading memories, huddled in the crypts with the dead, cursing Grey Aris for abandoning her, sobbing as they ran through the castle, slipping on blood and tripping on corpses, quaking beneath the blade of the now-dead Fury, who took her beauty and gave her strength, in the tower just before the battle, soaking her dress with tears, feeling so utterly alone. Never again. Ennis had requested not to be bound, but to be free at the end, and she had not begrudged him this honour. He stood before her on the execution slab, his chest bare. "Do you have any final words?" she asked. A hushed silence fell over the audience, as they craned their necks forward to hear what the dead man would say. Ennis looked at her without fear, without anger or malice, only with sadness. "Only some advice, my queen," he said. "Fire breeds fire, and even a single spark can birth an inferno." Rhea immediately recognized the quote from a favorite book of hers as a child, The Brave Mouse. She remembered how many times she asked Ennis to read it to her, and though he must have been bored with the same old story, he never refused her, In the tale, the mouse was forced to choose between saving his one true love from a fire or sacrificing her to save the rest of the mouse village. In the end, the mouse watched his love vanish into the flames while he ran to save the village with a bucket of water. Once the fire was extinguished, he drowned himself out of grief. A morbid tale, to be sure, but one that Rhea always thought was so romantic, especially because the girl mouse ended up surviving with very bad burns, unbeknownst to the brave mouse, who was already dead.
Appropriate for the occasion, Rhea thought. But she wouldn't let mere words pierce the armour she'd donned that morning. "Wise words, Cousin Ennis," she said. "But in this story, I am the Inferno." Rhea the Inferno. Add that to your list of names for your great queen.
The crowd grew restless as Ennis continued to meet her eyes, refusing to do the decent thing and look away.
"So be it."
Rhea raised her blade and plunged it into his heart. His eyes widened and he gasped, clutching at the hilt, but Rhea didn't see him fall. She'd already slipped the knife, which was oozing with blood, inside her hip scabbard. She turned to face her people. A tear crept from the corner of her eye, rolling down her cheek.
"Today, my heart is heavy. My cousin was a good man, a servant of Roth. But during the battle, his actions were misguided. He believed my life was more important than the lifeblood of the realm."
On the edge of her vision, Ennis's body stopped shuddering, going still.
"To that I say nay. I am but one woman, a mere mortal, while the realm is eternal. Roth is eternal, and God's will shall be done long after I am gone. So to all of you I say, serve me, yes, but only to the extent that in serving me you serve the realm. My dear cousin forgot that, and it cost him his honour and his life. The seventh heaven will be barred to him, but I am hopeful he will gain entrance later, and that one day we will meet again in Roth's holy presence."
"Roth be with you, Queen Rhea,"
the people said as one. She nodded solemnly, pressing her fingertips to her lips. She kissed them, and then turned to close Ennis's eyes. That's when she heard a voice carry through the crowd.
"Sister, what have you done?"
The voice was too deep to be B or Leo's, and who else would call her sister? One of her cousins, perhaps? But when she spun around, her eyes narrowing, squinting across the brightly lit courtyard, she saw someone else making their way through the human tide. Her heart rattled in her chest.
"Father?"
she whispered. But no, he was too young, without the streaks of grey in his hair nor crow's feet on the edges of his eyes. He was tall and built like a bowstring. His long hair reminded Rhea of her mother's. As the man swam through the crowd, Rhea's fury crowded closer together to block his passage. The blonde man with her father's features stopped.
"Rhea, it's me. It's your brother, Roan. At long last, I've come home."
Rhea was just a suckling babe when her brother had vanished mysteriously 16 long years ago, at the age of only 2. 3 years after that, her mother had killed herself. Her father had rarely spoken to Rhea of Roan or her mother. And when he did, the words had seemed to choke out of him. Thus, much of the information she had gathered about her lost sibling was gleaned from rumours. A particularly bratty lordling had told Rhea that Roan had run away from home because his parents were as cold as snakes. Rhea had been so angry she'd sputtered and fumed and eventually walked away from him. It didn't even matter that the story was clearly untrue. What 2-year-old child could run away from home? That night, she'd hidden a beehive under the boy's bed. His screams could be heard throughout the entire palace. But the most popular opinion was that Roan had been kidnapped by a man from the south, a grey-skinned dreadnoughter named Markin Swansea, who'd been a friend of her mother's. They said he was secretly a Southron spy who wanted to destroy the royal line by removing the eldest heir. There was even talk of murder. As far as Rhea's mother went, some said Cecilia Loren had gone mad after her son's disappearance, becoming a raving woman with little control over her own actions. Others said Cecilia Loren had stabbed herself after receiving a message while in court. Rhea didn't know what to believe, and she'd long ago given up on knowing the truth. Sometimes the truth is as impossible to reach out and grab as a star in the heavens, Rhea mused now. She waited on her throne, alone, save for the blank-faced Furia lining the walls. They weren't very good company, so Rhea remained silent, lost in her own thoughts. She'd only been 3 when her mother had died, so any memories she had of her were fuzzy around the edges, like a piece of parchment soaked in water and dried in the sun. But she'd always remember her golden hair, the way it cascaded around her shoulders like a sunlit waterfall. In her faint memories, her mother was an angel. The door opened, and she shook her thoughts away.
Mother is dead. Father is dead. I am alive. And this man claiming to be my long-lost brother, Roan? He's a ghost.
And yet, when she saw his lustrous blonde hair, all she could think about was her mother. She tried to focus as he was escorted through the court. As she'd instructed, he was not in chains, permitted to walk freely, like any other petitioner. If this was truly her brother... She shook away the thought. One of the Furia stuck out an arm to stop him when he reached the steps up to the throne.
"Sister," the man said.
The Furia kicked out the back of his knees, so he was forced to kneel.
"Your Highness," she corrected.
Rhea raised an eyebrow. Soon the Furia would need to choose a new Fury, or even all 3, considering the other 2 still had not been heard from. The warrior with the thick red eyebrows had potential. The man claiming to be Roan grimaced, but didn't cry out. He looked up at Rhea.
"Your Highness, Queen Rhea, my sister, I implore you to listen to what I have to say."
"Implore me?" Rhea said. "You claim to be my brother, the lost Prince of the West. How daft do you think I am? If you will only hear me out, they say you are righteous, sister." "Stop calling me that," Rhea growled.
But those eyes, as blue and fathomless as the crystal blue sea, just like her father's had been, they were unmistakable.
"You cannot fight the truth. I am the truth. I have conquered the Northern Armada and summoned Rathos from the sea."
"So I've heard." "That is good. Lord Griswold is an evil man."
"I don't know you. Your opinion is of no import to me."
The man sighed deeply.
"You are right. I have bungled this introduction badly, I'm afraid. Let me start at the beginning."
Though Rhea was tempted to stop him before he started, she didn't. And once he'd begun, she couldn't bring herself to do anything but listen as he told his tale. If it was a lie, it was well spun. He told her how their mother had given him over to the Dreadnought of Markin Swansea, charging him with keeping Roan safe. How he'd grown up on the streets of Calypso after running away from his guardian at age 8. How he'd contracted the plague, but somehow managed to fight off the infection and escape Dragon's Breath, washing up on the eastern shores. Then came his chance meeting with Prince Gareth Ironclad. Rhea couldn't help but lift her eyebrows at that part. And his brief stay in Faerir, the Iron City, before marching to Raiders Pass and participating in a bloody battle with the Gaerics in the north. Not Lord Griswold, but Archer and Anise, the son and daughter of the Dread King, both of whom were her cousins. And finally, how he'd departed in defeat, fording the Snake River and fighting through the Tangle, to eventually arrive in Night's End. When he'd finished, Rhea brought her hands together in a slow clap.
"Bravo," she said. "But if I'd wanted fiction, I'd have visited my personal library."
"You think I'm lying?"
"Either that, or you were born with an addled mind."
"Please," Roan said. "I came here in good faith."
"Why?"
Rhea said.
"To claim the throne for your own? Even if you are my brother, you are no heir, not any more. I am the anointed queen, Rhea the righteous, defender of the West. You have no claim here.
That's not why I'm here, Rhone said.
Rhea stared at him, considering.
There was a crucial element missing from your story. An unanswered question.
The man nodded.
Yes.
Why did my mother, Cecilia Loren, send you south with Markin Swansea? You said she charged the Dreadnoughter with keeping you safe. Why would you need to be protected when I did not? What made you different?
Instead of answering directly, he said,
I came here to visit the Western Archives, not to steal your crown.
Rhea frowned. The faces of the two dead archivists floated across her mind. The burnt document.
There are no coincidences.
For what purpose? Tell me before I send you to the gallows.
Research.
Her frown deepened.
Another vague answer. My patience is growing thin. Another one will be the end of you.
Rhone sighed, his lips pursing. He seemed to be considering something.
Sister, I am tired of lies and secrets. So tired. All I want is answers. I want to know who I am, why I grew up in Calypso while you were here in Night's End. I want to know what my true purpose is.
And you believe the Western Archives can tell you all that?
She was missing something.
Yes. All I want is information on the Western Oracle.
It took all of Rhea's concentration to keep her expression steady, though underneath her skin her blood was rushing through her veins.
The Western Oracle was a dark sorceress. Why would you seek to read of her dark magic?
Because of the fate marks, Rhone said.
His eyes were boring into hers, searching for something.
You mean sin marks, I presume?
Fate marks, fate marks, fate marks. The word echoed in her ears.
That is the name you give them now. But it wasn't always that way.
Rhea had discovered as much in her own research, but how had this man come to that same knowledge?
Let's say I believe everything you've told me, though that is an enormous assumption. What does any of it have to do with understanding your purpose? What does your quest offer me?
He closed his eyes, holding them like that for a while, so long that Rhea wondered whether he'd fallen asleep. When he opened them, his eyes flashed with certainty. He'd made a decision.
"Do you have a torch?" he asked.
She narrowed her eyes.
"Why?"
"I want to show you something."
"Bring fire,"
Rhea said, and several Furia rushed to obey her order. A torch was lit and brought nearer.
"Closer,"
Rhone said. He unbuttoned his linen shirt, pulling the wings back to reveal a smooth, muscular chest. Something sparked, and bright lines began to form, curling, drawing themselves into his flesh. Three leaves attached to a single stem. He was marked. Rhea breathed in, holding the air in her lungs, her eyes unblinking. The mysteries of Rhea's past were connected one by one, forming a single, clear picture. She released her breath and stood.
"Bring the sin marked to my personal quarters. Leave us alone."
Despite the harshness of her words, she knew the truth. He was her lost brother, Rhone Loren, the true heir to the Western throne.
My throne.
35. The Western Kingdom, the Dead Isles. Grey Aris. Grey's hand was sweaty, and instinctively he reached for his other hand, desperate for something to hold on to steady himself. When his fingers closed around the ruined stump of his arm, something bent inside of him. A part of him that used to be broken. Perhaps still was broken. It was hard for him to tell anymore. Somewhere outside the stone building, wind howled. Rain pounded. Waves crashed on a dead and uncaring shore.
"Don't do this," Gray said. "Kill me, but not in front of Shay. She's been through enough." "We have to know the truth," the Fury said.
And Gray was surprised to get an answer from the hard-faced woman. She sounded different somehow. More desperate. More urgent.
"Why? Why do you care about Shay's mark?"
"Sin mark,"
the Fury reminded him.
"She's just a girl. She's no threat."
The Fury whirled on him, grabbing his cheeks between her icy fingers, squeezing.
"You know nothing."
Gray couldn't argue with that.
"Then tell me what you mean."
A thump resounded from somewhere above them.
"Are we underground?"
They must be, for the stone structure was only one level atop the cliff. The Fury's gaze flitted to the ceiling, boring holes in it.
"Hurry,"
she said, dragging him forward by the arm. Somewhere further along the dim corridor, the other Fury also urged them to make haste. Dozens of Furia ran down an intersecting tunnel before flying up a steep set of stairs that winded away. They carried weapons.
Thump! "What is happening?"
Gray asked, trying to squirm away from the Fury.
Thump!
The Fury turned quickly, her arm lashing out and backhanding Gray across the face. Stunned, Gray spat out a glob of blood. The other Fury ran back, grabbing him under his other arm. He kicked and fought every step, but they carried him down the hall, shoving him roughly into a room. Wall sconces blazed brightly from each corner, intersecting in the center of the space.
Where she hung.
Shay.
Oh, gods.
The chains were clasped to each wrist, dangling from iron hooks pounded into the stone ceiling. The flesh around the chains was puffy and red, her skin raw-looking. Her chin was pressed against her chest, her eyes closed, her strawberry-gold hair oily and stringy, covering part of her face. She was stripped to naught but a thin white slip, which was soaked, revealing her pale, skinny arms and legs. There were angry burns on one arm and red slashes on the other. The rest of the small stone prison was empty, save for a small table with a book lying on it, flipped open to a page littered with scrawls of dark, shaky handwriting. Gray immediately noticed a drawing of a symbol. It was like half of a broken key, the end you would push into a lock first. The same strange symbol had been drawn in ink on various parts of Shay's body, her palms, her knees, her feet, which, he now realized, was also drawn next to the mark she was born with, clearly visible on her palm due to the torchlight illuminating her skin. What he'd always thought was a golden crown attached to some sort of broken scepter had really been something else entirely. The other half of a broken key, now completed by the ink on her hand. It was exactly the same as the key he'd imagined in the stars.
"Shay,"
Gray said, taking a step toward his sister. Strong arms yanked him back, held him. His sister didn't stir, motionless.
"Is she already dead?"
Gray thought, a slash of icy dread wrenching through him.
"Do you know how the Dead Isles got their name?"
one of the Furies asked.
"I don't care about... It was the original Furies,"
she continued as if he hadn't spoken.
"Do you think we were always the undisputed priestesses of Wrath in the West? No. Nothing worthwhile is ever easy. There were those who opposed my sisters, the strongest of which was a group of men called the Seekers, who believed women were inferior to men. Can you believe such a notion? Anyway, there was a battle, and those who came before me and my sisters won. They slaughtered the Seekers, all of them. But there were others like them, and the Furia needed to send a message. So the first Furies brought the bodies of their enemies to these very isles, and called upon Wrath's blessing. Now the souls of the Seekers haunt this place, a warning to those who think to defy us."
Gray shook his head. It sounded like a bedtime story. A bad bedtime story.
"What does that have to do with me? Because from that day forward, when Roth blessed these islands, any who died upon their shores was cursed to live on through eternity, chained to the second heaven, a fate even worse than the first heaven. When you die, you will receive the same fate.
Grey had had enough of threats.
Shay!
He shouted again. His sister opened her eyes slowly, her eyelids fluttering.
I hate the dreams the most,
she said.
I don't want to dream any more.
She was clearly confused. How long had she been chained in this room? When had she last eaten, tasted water on her lips?
I'm here, Shay, Grey said. I'm really here.
Tears dripped from his eyelids. Shay shook her head.
Go away. I don't want to hope any more.
She's been dreaming of me,
Grey realized.
That I would come to rescue her. I'm her hope. But what if I'm not good enough? What if I'm not strong enough? What if my parents were wrong to trust me with her life, her secrets?
Another heavy crash from above drew him away from his insecurities and back to reality. All his doubts didn't matter, not in this moment. He would save her or die trying.
Tell us about your sin, Mark,
the Fury instructed Shay.
Or your brother dies.
A hand wrapped around his neck, a blade pressed to his skin. He could feel his pulse pounding against the cold metal. Shay blinked.
Grey?
I'm here.
You came?
I came.
Your hand?
They took it, but they couldn't stop me.
I'm sorry.
Fresh tears bloomed.
No, you have nothing to be sorry about. This was my fault, do you hear? You've done nothing wrong. Nothing.
Grey, I'm scared.
Thump, thump, thump.
Tell us what we need to know,
the Fury commanded. The blade cut into his skin, and Grey felt warmth run down his neck.
My mark doesn't do anything,
Shay said, a plea in her voice.
It's never done anything.
She's telling the truth,
Grey said, trying not to move, not to press his skin further into the blade.
One swipe and he's dead,
the Fury said.
Would you let your brother die, Shay? It will be you killing him.
No!
Shay screamed.
He didn't do anything. Let him go. I will tell you everything. I will tell you about the dreams.
Thump, 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 crash. Grey didn't have time to process his sister's words as shouts poured from above. There was the sound of steel on steel, the clop of what sounded like hooves on stone, and then more thuds and thumps.
Damn it!
One of the Furies yelled.
The door has been breached. We have to help our sisters. Leave them. We'll return.
The Fury holding the knife to Grey's throat growled her frustration, but then drew her blade away, leaving him gasping. She kicked him hard from behind, and he sprawled to his knees. And then they were gone, slamming the door behind them. A key turned in a lock. Grey fought to his feet, ignoring the screams of battle, the clash of metal, the cries of pain. Only she mattered. Only Shay.
We have to get you out of here,
he said.
They have the only key,
she said.
They took it with them.
There must be another way.
There is,
she said.
What? Pull me down, she said. By the feet.
Shay, do it. Hurry. The dead are coming.
The cries were closer now, and Grey swore he heard the whinny of a horse.
The dead? What was she talking about?
Surely she didn't believe the Fury's fairy tales.
They've been attacking for days, Grey. The dead horsemen. I've heard the Fury are talking about them. They're scared of them. But they've never gotten inside. Until now. We have to go. Now.
Grey bit the back of his hand, shocked by the potency of his sister's delusions. He couldn't do this, could he? He knew he was out of options. It was the only choice. The shackles were tight on her wrists, but not that tight. She was all skin and bones.
I don't want to hurt you. "You could never hurt me, Grey," she said. And he was shocked at how grown up she sounded. How strong. "Where has my baby sister gone?" Grey wondered.
He grabbed her ankles, taking a deep breath. Something pounded on the door hard. The thump.
"Grey!"
Shay cried.
"I'm sorry,"
he said. And then he pulled. She screamed, but when he stopped pulling, she shouted at him to
"keep going! Keep going!"
He gripped her feet harder and yanked them down, shutting his mind off to his sister's cries, which were equal parts pain and determination. She'd been through hell and back already, but Grey couldn't give up on her now. Her body stretched, and he feared he would pull her in half, but then she shot downwards like a dropped stone, crashing into him, her knee slamming into his abdomen, her head bashing his shoulder, her foot stepping on the inside of his ankle. The pain was nothing as he held her, as he wept into her hair, as she cried into his drenched, filthy shirt. Her wrists were ripped and bleeding, as were her knuckles, but she was free. The thump. The hit to the door was so hard it rattled the whole room, a stark reminder to Grey that they were far from safe. Clearly it wasn't the Furies, who would have simply used the key to get in.
"What are they?"
Grey said. Shay rolled off him and said,
"Get behind me." "Who is this girl?"
"What?"
"No."
Grey stood and tried to push her behind him as the door shook once more. Whatever was out there was strong. Grey didn't know if they were dead horsemen or something else, but he knew they would need to move fast as soon as that door came down.
"Grey,"
Shay said, touching his hand. He ignored her, his mind searching for a solution. When the door came down, which it certainly would, there'd be a moment of confusion. It might be the only moment they'd get. "By the side of the door," Grey said. "Get ready to run." Shay was barefoot, but it didn't matter. Getting away from whatever was beating on the door was the priority.
"Grey,"
she said again. This time she touched his cheek, steering his gaze toward her.
"Trust me."
"Trust her with what?" He tried to pull her toward the side of the door, but instead she stepped in front of him.
"Shay, what are you— make yourself as small as you can," she said.
The thump. This time the stones above the door cracked. The thump. Grey tried to grab his sister, but she was slippery, pulling away, maintaining her position in front of him. The thump. Rock dust rained from the ceiling, and the door released a mournful groan. The thump. The hinges snapped, and the door began to fall. Grey dragged his sister back by the waist, but she stepped on his feet so he couldn't swing her around. The heavy iron door slammed into the ground, the clang reverberating throughout the room. They both froze. Its skin was like stretched white silk, icy-looking, glowing unnaturally. Its head was that of a man, but with completely white eyes, like it was blind. Its hair was roiling waves crashing on its white rock scalp. Its arms and torso were muscular, a long stone sword gripped tightly by white-knuckled fingers. Blood dripped from the blade. Beneath its torso, its body transitioned to that of a pale white horse, with a broad horizontal back and undercarriage held up by four powerful hooved legs. As Grey stared over his sister's shoulder in fascinated horror, he realized he could see right through the creature, faintly, like peering through foggy glass.
"Not dead horsemen,"
he realized.
"Dead horsemen."
Suddenly all the ghost stories about the Dead Isles didn't seem so far-fetched. Was this one of the Seekers the Fury had spoken of? Without taking his eyes off the man, horse, thing, Grey tried to nudge his sister toward the side of the room. Perhaps if it really was blind, they might be able to slip past it and into the corridor. She reached back and grabbed his hair, pulling it. Her eyes found his, boring into him.
"Get behind me. Trust me. Make yourself small."
Grey knew he owed his sister more than he could ever repay her. His life, yes. And certainly her trust. Slowly, he ducked behind her, bringing his legs together and squeezing his arms in front of him. The horseman stepped forward, his hooves clopping on the stone. He stepped so close to Shay that Grey could have reached between her legs and touched its leg, though he wondered whether his hand would go right through it. The creature let out a breath that sounded more hoarse than man, one of its hooves pawing at the rock floor. With a squeal, it turned and departed, charging through the doorway. Shay turned, her face as calm as a flower on a spring day.
"Now we can go," she said.
As Shay led him into the corridor, Grey didn't demand an explanation for any of it. There was no time, and anyway, he didn't know where to start. His sister was changing, becoming something different. But then again, so was he. They ducked back into the room when they saw three dead horsemen filling the hallway to the right. Grey also saw the bodies. The Furia, their red robes flung haphazardly about their bodies. Had any of them survived? If fierce warriors like them were defeated so easily, what would that mean for Grey and his sister? Nothing, Grey thought. We make our own path. It wasn't until he thought it that he truly believed it. No longer would they swim with the current nor against it. They would swim across it, and together they would reach dry land.
The way out is blocked, Shay said. Then we'll find another way, a better way.
Shay's eyes locked on his, and she nodded.
Follow me.
I will follow you anywhere. She was about to leave again when she paused, taking two quick steps over to the table. She picked up the book with the markings, tucking it to her chest, and then returned to Grey's side. Gripping the book in one hand, she tiptoed out into the corridor and turned left, back toward where Grey had been held captive. Grey stalked after her, sidestepping a body. One of the Furies. The one who had taken his hand, who had threatened to slit his throat. She was missing both arms. A stone sword was buried in her chest. Grey moved on, glancing behind him once as they turned the corner. One of the horsemen was looking down the hall. He shouted something in a strange language, and dozens of hoofbeats rang out behind them.
"Hurry,"
Grey said, pushing his sister in the small of her back, adding momentum to her strides. Ahead of them, the path seemed to dead-end, but Shay didn't try to slow her strides. At the last second, she pulled him to the right, into a narrow gash in the wall. They were forced to shimmy side to side to make their way through. An arm chased after them, leading with a stone sword. It flew toward Grey's head, and he flinched back, but then it stopped with the point a fingernail away from his eye. The horseman screamed something nonsensical and jabbed again, but Grey had already moved further away, and again the sword came up short. His horse hips were too wide to breach the narrow space. Perhaps it was an intentional part of the building's design, by whomever had built it. When Grey looked back, the horseman was gone, off to find another way to get to them. Shay reached a thin alcove and turned right, disappearing.
"Wait,"
Grey said, and her hand shot out. He reached for it, and she pulled him onto a set of narrow stairs, which seemed to go up and up forever into darkness. They climbed blindly, single file. With each step, Grey expected to hear the scream of the horsemen, feel a stone blade in his back. But he knew his mind was his worst enemy. The dead couldn't follow them through this path. Somehow the stone stopped them. Finally, when his legs were beyond exhaustion, they reached something solid. Together they pressed all three of their hands against it and pushed as one. Slowly, slowly, the stone barrier slid away, revealing a crack of grey sky and swirling mist. They stole onto the edge of a night-black cliff, high above the ocean. Below, angry waves smashed against the impenetrable island of the dead. The drop-off was sheer. There was no way to climb down. Grey realized it was the same side of the island he'd arrived on. He even spotted part of his small boat wrecked on a jagged rock, sticking up like the claw of a sea monster. The only advantage was that this particular cliff hung out over the water, somewhat clear of the rocky shoreline. But was it far enough? Horsemen screamed from somewhere through the mist, and they whirled around, searching the rocky landscape.
"They're coming," Shay said. "I can't hide you forever."
Grey still didn't understand exactly how his little sister had done what she had done, but he didn't need to. Not anymore. "We have to swim," he said. A glowing white figure emerged from the mist, then another. Dozens more followed, screaming, brandishing stone swords. They turned back toward the ocean, and Grey grabbed his sister's hand. There was no other choice. The overhanging cliff would have to be far enough over the water, else they were dead.
"Ready?"
Shay nodded, her jaw set. Grey knew his sister was scared of heights and water. But that was a different girl. This version of Shay had been through so much more terror that a leap from a cliff into the ocean was nothing. They leapt, their arms and legs windmilling. Wind and rain pelted their faces. Waves roared, rushing up to meet them. And then the sea swallowed them whole. In the depths of the sea, under the cloud-grey sky, Grey immediately lost all sense of direction. He also lost Shay's hand when they plunged underwater, and now he frantically searched, flailing his arms from side to side. He thought he felt his fingers brush up against her, but then she was gone again. On and on he searched, reaching into murk and gloom, his desperation growing as his lungs began to burn. He couldn't lose her now, not after everything they'd both been through. For the first time in his life he prayed, not to Roth, the vengeful god of the Furia, but to whatever power created the sun and the moons and the stars and the ocean.
"Please, release her. Give her back to me. Spit her out."
He couldn't hold his breath any longer, and he kicked hard in the direction he thought looked slightly lighter, a muted shade of grey. Water threatened to tear open his mouth and pour inside. But still he kicked, even when he felt a dark shadow loom to the side and he was thrown against a rock. He clawed at the stone, pulling himself up, 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 finally breaching the surface, his pale hand clutching the jagged stone like the edge of a lifeboat. His lips murmured his prayer, even as the waves pounded him, crashing on his head, knocking him to and fro like a shattered piece of driftwood.
"Please, release her."
And then he spoke the two words he'd been thinking from the moment his sister was taken.
"Take me instead,"
he whispered to the wind. Louder.
"Take me, not her,"
shouted at the top of his lungs, his voice rising over the pounding waves and howling wind and rainfall.
"Take me!"
Arms grabbed him from behind, clinging to his waist. He looked back, and there she was, Shay, wearing that same determined expression.
"Don't go," she said. "Don't let them take you."
He wasn't ashamed to cry. Not now. Not ever again. The tears poured from his eyes, mixing with the rain and seawater.
"Never," he said. "You're all I've got."
And then he shoved off from the jagged rock, kicking as hard as he could against the current, which threatened to sweep them back toward the island. Shay clutched his waist, and he swam with one arm, fighting past the breakers, looking back only once the powerful current had released them. High on the cliffs the dead stood, watching, waiting. There were dozens of horsemen, and instinctively Grey knew they were unsatisfied, despite having feasted on the souls of the Furia, who, according to the Fury's story, would rise again to haunt the isles. They were hungry, ravenous, because they had lost two souls from their shores. Grey turned away and didn't look back again. All Grey knew was that he needed to follow the sun. He wasn't sure exactly how far the Dead Isles were from the coastline, but thus far he'd seen nothing but endless ocean ever since the misty islands vanished from view. The sun had reached its peak long ago and was now drifting toward the horizon. Grey was chasing it, but he was swiftly falling behind. At some point, Shay fell asleep, leaving Grey to drag her body through the choppy water. At some point, Grey became too weary to kick, to swim, letting their bodies drift with the current, which was moving swiftly south. He had seen maps of the Four Kingdoms, and he was fairly certain the Phoenician Peninsula eventually jutted out, which could mean they would run directly into it. But that was almost certainly days away, if not weeks. They would die of thirst or starvation long before that. So he conserved his energy for a while, and then swam again, pushing eastward. In her sleep, Shay's body was as heavy as a corpse, a thought that made Grey want to wake her up, just to be certain she was alive. But he didn't, letting her sleep. Anyway, he could feel her warm exhalations on his cheeks. The sun stole the daylight, and night descended like a scythe. The moons appeared, first the one southerners worshipped as Luahi,